Now to continue with Steve Jacobson, he has a few things to say, and then we'll open up to questions from the audience to him, and also we'll give Steve the opportunity to ask any questions he might have of us.
I think you got my notes again. But we have compassion for each other, so we're good. We're good. It just makes us stronger. Okay, I mentioned what teens learn, I'm going to have to just tell you one quick story about our spiritual care program. It's very clearly based on the idea that we're in a postmodern world, that traditional religious affiliations are still working for some people, but for many people they aren't. So the two people we have working for us, one is Quaker, the other is Buddhist, but they're very comfortable and effective moving across any territory that comes along. So one of our, Laura, one of our spiritual care people, was working with a woman who was terminal, dying, and she had a very strong Buddhist practice and a strong introvert, and she was very satisfied being alone most of the time. It didn't feel disconnected for her. But she had a brother, as Laura found out, who was very close to her, but lived in Minnesota. He was a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic, and he felt he wanted to be more connected with her, but couldn't come out, and she didn't really want him to. And so what Laura figured out was she set it up with them that every evening at 6, when the sister would go into meditation, the brother back in Minneapolis at 8 o'clock would go into prayer. And he'd pray for her at the same time she was meditating and bringing him to her mindfulness. So every evening they were connected, even though they were not on Skype. They weren't physically in the same room. But so when she died and he came out for the service, they scattered her ashes out by the Channel Islands. He, as a cardiologist at Mayo Clinic, he said, "I've never imagined there'd be something like that that was so powerful." So I'm just giving you a plug for our spiritual care program in terms of the creativity that's involved in it in the postmodern world, but also how those connections can be all kinds of different ways. Okay. Do all of you know the five wishes? Okay. We'll pass on. Okay, sorry. Okay, five wishes. This is a very practical thing. People talk about getting an advance directive, which is if I am in an accident going home today and I'm at Cottage Hospital, do they put tubes in depending, you know, on what my prognosis is? And also a durable power of attorney. Who is it that that if my neither my wife nor I can speak for me, who do I want to speak for me to know my wishes? So that's a traditional, if you do a will and estate plan, that's a very traditional two-part thing. But five wishes is a very strong, growing practice across the country. In almost every state now, it's a legal document. It includes those first two, but it also includes three other wishes. How comfortable do I want to be? How I want people to treat me? Like, do I want to be maybe massaged occasionally? Do I want to have music in my room? And for instance, they have a series of bullet points, and you can leave them there if you like that. If you don't like it, you cross it out. You can also write your own directions. So for me, under music, I put Bach, Mozart, and Neil Young. And I said, no clowns. Nothing against clowns, but I don't want to be dying and have a clown come in. I just don't. So the last part is, what do I want my loved ones to know? So you can write in there about, you know, that I appreciative for my life, or you know, the silver is hidden under the bed, or whatever. But it's called Advanced Directives with a Heart, and so it's a wonderful document. And you can call us to get a copy. You can go online, but we do workshops in town. And next month there's a big campaign in town with Cottage Hospital and Visiting Nurse and Hospice Santa Barbara to really encourage people to get it done, get them in, and it's really important to have a conversation with those people that would be involved so that they know exactly what you want. A recent study, 42% of people that got admitted at Cottage Hospital that had advance directives, the advance directives were not followed because the family protested and did not want them to be followed. There had not been a conversation with the person, say, that was me, and my kids. So in the emotional throes of the moment, it's very hard for them to say, Dad doesn't want all that. It's very hard. But if, like, when I filled out mine, then I sat down with my daughters and I said, here's what I want, you know, and we had a good conversation, okay. Cottage Hospital, Ron Werft from Cottage Hospital has said, what a difference it is for the hospital when a family comes in and they've completed five wishes, because then the whole staff can just focus on caring for people, not on family distress. So if you'd like to know more about five wishes, you can contact us, visiting nurse, Cottage Hospital, but really it's a very important thing. And yes?
I want to set a good example by using the microphone. A quick question. I always wondered, after you filled out five wishes, where you brought it, or do you stick it on the fridge? What do you do with it?
Right. That's a great question. So give it to your doctor, and some doctors don't really like to talk about it, but you got to give it to them. Got to make them toughen up and get it in the file. And just recently, Cottage Hospital is now scanning advanced directives. You could go in there, not at a time you're being admitted. You can say that you want your documents in there, and they'll scan them and put them in their system. It's a pretty new operation going, but it's a part of that whole thing. And there's even Microsoft has a product. It's called, like, the Health Vault, where you can put it on an online service. So if you're in Europe and it happens, you can access it online, give it to anybody. So it's a big and we can help figure all that out. But I'll just say one thing. My first person to make decisions for me after my wife was my oldest daughter. I have three daughters. And then I went to a workshop where they said, you know, the person that should be number one should be somebody who is really accessible by cell phone. And my daughter lives in India and doesn't have a cell phone. So I was like, probably not a good idea. So I made my number two daughter, who's in town, uses her cell phone all the time. She can communicate with the other daughters. But just those kinds of things to think about very practically. Okay. Last thing I want to mention, I was going to say death is not a Martha Stewart thing usually. So I hope Martha has a good, compassionate journey, but sometimes people try to create it so perfectly, but life has a way of messing it up. And sometimes what life does is better than what Martha could have figured out. So anyway, but just to close, there's a physician, Ira Byock, who wrote a book called Four Things That Matter Most, and talks about, as a physician, when he would go around, sometimes nothing more could be done pain-wise, and families say, what else could we do? And he would start writing down the first four phrases you see here. I love you, please forgive me, I forgive you, thank you. And he'd say, take this, talk it over with your family, and if your loved one is still conscious, does anybody need to say any of that? Another physician in New England added two more in a journal in palliative medicine, which was goodbye and I'm proud of you. So, I have here business cards, I mean, the cards that have these six phrases on them. And I hope everybody will take one or two or three. When my dad was, last couple days, he wasn't talking much anymore. My sister came down from Santa Cruz. Three of us were there. After a while, you don't really know what to do. We took this out. And we just looked at it, and we would say to my dad, you know, Dad, I love you because da-da-da. I forgive you for that time you gave me a pretty bad spanking. Please forgive me for that time that I didn't come home that night and kept you up. Just to go down, it's a very simple list, but it's like a basic checklist of human relationships, of things to say. And that thank you is especially, or I'm proud of you, is especially useful in a relationship with children. If somebody is in their last days or hours and they think about it and they say, you know, I am really proud of you. What does that mean to somebody to hear it from your parent? Some of their last words, I am proud of you. This is not only a great thing to have in that situation, but it's a good thing to carry around anytime to think about your day. Is there anybody I need to say these six things to? I did a workshop at La Casa, and part of it was I did a presentation on this. And so I said, okay, I want everybody right now, just take it, 45 minutes, and think about, is there anybody you need to say this, any of these things to? You can do it by email, you can get on your cell phone, you can do whatever you want. Do it now, you know. So then when we came back, And I asked people for their reaction, and one lady said, well, I texted my daughter and said, I really love you. And she called back and said, oh my God, what's wrong? So maybe you got to preface it a little bit. But again, this is best practices in this work. And what's always so profound to me is this is kind of best practices in life. You know, pretty good list. Related to these traditions, most of them have these kinds of things as values. So I do want everybody to take one of these cards, put it in your wallet. You never know when you may need it. I'll stop there. Okay, let's do some Q&A. Oh, yeah, please. And if you want to take two or three, please do. Our staff uses them all the time at the hospital and other places. Simple, people get it. Questions of any kind? Oh, good. Thank you for... Yeah, once you ask your question, then I'll absolutely go back
number
to
number five said, on the sheet says you're going to tell us what happened to the nurse.
Thank you. Right. The nurse has been a volunteer for us for 34 years. She doesn't do any nursing. She just is with people. And she found that she could still be a nurse and she could be compassionate while being a nurse. But one of the most meaningful things in her life was to become a hospice volunteer and to cultivate that kind of presence and be with people. We have three volunteers who have been with us more than 30 years. Anne Smith-Core, some of you may know Anne, who's a volunteer for us, a visiting nurse and Dream Foundation. Extraordinary guy named Joe Joel. Some of you might know Joe from the Catholic parish up there. And Muriel Ross. And Anne Smith-Core has been volunteering for us for 30-some years. She says every time she goes to a new house, she's nervous and feels inadequate, which is really important. Inadequacy is an appropriate feeling, but being present is as well. So any reflections, you know, from a good or bad death of anything I said about your own reflections or just questions you have? You know, yeah, Terry.
Hi, Steve. So this is really more about the five wishes. I just want to
please.
Add. It's since I just did that and was trained in it, if you take it to Cottage, they just take it up to medical records and download it. And if you make a copy of it so that it's not the booklet, that it's one page at a time, it takes them like 3 seconds, and it's downloaded into the system. And if your doctor is at Sansum, as mine is, I took it to his office and gave it to his nurse, and she said, we'll put it into the Sansum thing. Once I'd done that, I just had a great sense of peace. Like, okay, it's everywhere it needs to be. I've had the conversation. And so I really recommend it because it's just a burden off your shoulders. And both systems are equally happy to download them.
It makes living better.
Yes.
You know, because you've dealt with it, had a conversation, and you don't have to worry about it. Will I ever have that conversation? Yeah, Ernie.
I wanted to share a reflection on what seemed to be a really good death. My wonderful mother-in-law in Australia died about a year and a half ago. Pancreatic cancer. She was 92, and she said the doctors kept asking her if she was in pain, but she says, I'm not, which was a wonderful blessing. But the day before she died, when she woke up that morning, according to Allison's sister, she seemed really surprised to still be here and a bit disappointed. And she told people, I died yesterday. And then she didn't say anything for the next day, and she passed. She was really ready. Question, you said early on you were going to come back to the story about the nurse who couldn't sleep. Unless I missed it, I don't think you did. Come back.
Just
to
did.
Was that nurse?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry, same nurse.
I forgive
Sorry.
You.
Sorry, yeah, yeah.
Forgive you.
Yeah, yeah.
Forgive me, please.
I have compassion and you have wisdom, so we're good. Yes.
Steve, I just wanted to add a note about the Buddhist woman and her brother, I think, in the cardiologist.
Yes, uh-huh.
That is a practice called kything, K-Y-T-H-I-N-G. It's actually been around for quite a while. There's a book on it. But also St. Therese of Lisieux, back in the late 1800s, did that with a prisoner who was on death row. And he converted, or at least he became peaceful with himself and with God. And it was apparently due to her prayer for him. So tithing is a wonderful practice. It's not talked about much, but there is a book out on it.
Oh, wonderful.
Thank you.
You know, a lot of these things that we're just recovering ancient things. It's good stuff. Yes?
Just I just want to point out, when my daughter was 8, we brought my sister-in-law home to die with us in our house. And I got so much flack from all the other moms, like, how could you put your daughter through that? And it was a loving, wonderful thing. So, and I sought some counseling along the way, you know, am I doing this correctly? And then when her grandmother died, it was wonderful. Again, so my daughter's experienced a lot of deaths firsthand. And it would be great if we could reach out to children, because I realized that when my sister-in-law was dying and I was having the conversation as she was dying with my daughter, we could make another choice if this gets to be too much, that I was building a container for my child, how she would face death the rest of her life. And I know that many of you are grandparents in here or parents, and I think that that is also an opportunity to have those conversations with children.
Absolutely.
Because mothers are so freaked out about, I don't want my kid, you know, and yet when some, or they lose a person, that first death experience, I think, is really setting the table for how that person will go through future death.
Absolutely.
As a, you know, this is a joyous occasion, or, I mean, and still have room for grief. So I just would encourage these conversations with children to, not at the time of death, but, you know, building that vehicle of how you're okay with dying. So
kids look to what their parents are modeling.
Yeah.
And so if you model, this is a part of life, we do compassion. Right. We're also practical.
Yeah.
That's how valuable can that be?
Yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, just another population we have the opportunity
Absolutely.
To help up front rather than later.
And I think everybody knows that until the Industrial Revolution, all dying happened in the homes, in the farms, rural areas. You see it all the time, animals, you know, and it was a part of life. Then we've disconnected it all, so it's like relearning that very thing. Yes?
Well, as I told you, I worked as a volunteer for hospice for 17
yes.
years. And the thing that struck me, and I still think back on it because I saw it again and again, was how much control people have over their own deaths. And so it happened so many times. For instance, not too many people died right before Christmas.
Most people wait through Christmas if they can. Yeah.
Friends were coming. Then we had this big rush in January. And one man, his biggest worry, he'd been with us almost 3 months, his insurance was going to run out. And he talked about that to me every time I saw him. And I came in on the day his insurance was going to run out, and he had died that night. And then I saw it work in my own life with my husband, who was hospitalized after an accident with this one thing after another, domino effect. But at any rate, he retained his love for football. And wherever he went, his biggest problem was, have they lost my Michigan football schedule? Went with him everywhere. Does this television in here give me the right, will it give me the channels I want? Well, one day I was sitting with him, and it was his worst day. They'd sent him back from the dialysis center because he had become unresponsive. He was given probably a few hours to live, and my daughter and I were sitting there holding his hand. He had the oxygen mask on, also the bypass. Forgotten what it's called. Anyway, it expels the carbon dioxide that he was having trouble getting rid of, and he needed it. All of a sudden, he woke up, he yanked off the mask. We were saying, no, no, no. Oh, I forgot something. Something came first. He died. He had no pulse and no respiration. And then suddenly this happens, you know, sometimes you have many times where you just about expire and then
absolutely
and then
right.
you go on. We saw the pulse beating in his neck, but we waited because we were sure it was the end. That's when he threw off the oxygen mask, grabbed the remote control, turned on the Michigan football game, and proceeded to watch the whole thing, making comments.
Really? Wow.
And Michigan lost very badly. And I think he decided, okay, I've seen all I want of Michigan. So he died a day and a half later, but perfectly peacefully, perfectly happily. So you can hang in there for things that are really important to you.
I think some of you may know. Yeah, some of you may know the Father Virgil when he was dying. I think the night before he died,
lot of people around praying and everything. And suddenly he came to and wanted to know what the Dodger score was, you know. He didn't ask for more prayers. He's, you know, what's the score? Yeah.
I have a question about the best wishes. Do you suggest giving a copy to your adult children?
Of what you've filled out?
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. And the most important thing is the conversation. Because sometimes they look at it and it's sometimes a difficult conversation to say, you know, you're home for Thanksgiving, let's talk about the five wishes or something. But whenever that can happen, it's really profound. It's good to give it to them. The best thing is to have any kind of conversation, because then if they're in that moment where they have to make a decision, they'll feel much more confident that it was what you wanted. Yeah, good point.
Two things I'd like to go back to because I didn't get them in their totality. And one is what spirituality is as defined by City of Hope people. The last line was significant something and something. And I don't know if you can go back to
that.
Yeah,
it's okay, sure. I'll be happy to give that back to you. Let's see here.
To the significant or significant. Okay, if you could keep that up for just a
minute. I will happily leave it up.
And then I would like to know the recipe for cherry juice, morphine.
I don't know if it's made public, but it's kind of Breaking Bad kind of a thing. But I have no idea what the proportions were.
Okay.
But it must have been... and a lot of the thing with pain control, and Dr. Carney is honestly an international expert, and his whole focus on controlling pain is so that the consciousness can be clear. Yeah, I mean, you know, as clear as possible. So I think, I'd like to think Cicely Saunders knew exactly how much to give so that they could still be conversing while feeling really good.
Okay, so what's in it?
I don't know.
Oh, you don't know? You just made that up?
No, I didn't make it up, but I don't know the proportion. Oh, you mean the four ingredients?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you wanted like a teaspoon of this.
Well, that would be fine,
I'm sorry.
Too. But
okay, morphine, cocaine, gin, and of course cherry juice.
Thank you.
A hospice gimlet or something, I don't know.
Hi, I'm Gloria. Thank you for coming. I had a friend about 30 years ago. She was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a raging person before she came to AA. And she never belonged anywhere, never been baptized, nothing, never
mm-hmm.
belonged. And what she wanted, I got her to a confirmation class, and she wanted to be baptized. So when she found out she had cancer, she did find out, and we had this party, a big group of people came to the house. And I know some of you may know Father Terry Ritchie. He was in Chatsworth at the time. And she was, that day she had chemotherapy. She was supposed to be really sick. That was back 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But she wasn't. She came prepared and she had her first communion, confirmation, sacrament of the sick. Mm. And I forget, what was the other one? There's another one in there. Whatever, she had a lot of them. And then when she was dying in the hospital, they had like a watch, which I think is critical for me, for people to come to the hospital and pray.
Mm-hmm. And like a vigil, kind of?
A what?
Like a vigil?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right, sure. Go ahead. Yeah.
And I had septic shock, and I was supposed to die. And my daughter had taken my phone book, and I had little stars by all the people I really loved and to call if I died or something. So she got all those people to come to the hospital.
Wow.
So I lived, obviously. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. Yeah, we have a program called NODA, No One Dies Alone. It's one of our volunteer programs. It's other parts of the country as well. And we have volunteers who want to be part of this. We do some training. And then they're on call at facilities in town, nursing homes and places. That if somebody's dying and they have no family or the family needs respite care, you go in for 2-hour shifts and just sit there. Maybe there's interaction and conversation. Maybe all there is just meditation or presence. And the belief is we do it at Via Alamar, the Alzheimer's facility right over here, that no one should die alone if it can be helped. Yes, please.
A little story about palliative care and a comment on good death versus bad death. So my dad was in the VA hospital after his second operation for lung cancer. I was visiting with him, and he was in obvious discomfort. And I said, "Dad," I said, ring for the nurse. You know, you can get some morphine." And he goes, "But I might get addicted." It took me aback for a second. I went, "Dad, I think that's the least of your worries." But the good death, bad death. So subsequently, he was in the ICU there, and I'd gone with a couple of my siblings to visit. And what a horrendous environment. I mean, I know those are important environments for people in a lot of cases. Right. But for someone who was dying,
absolutely,
had limited time, and we just went, we're taking him out of here. And, oh, my God, the doctor. Mm. Like, no, you can't do that. And we said, what do we need to sign? Thank goodness my older sister, the nurse, knew all the language to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And we just said, no, we're ordering an ambulance. Pull those tubes. We're taking him home. And that was a good death at home, in his own home, surrounded with his wife, my mother, who's still with us, thank God, his siblings, me and my siblings, taking care of him, along with the assistance of, God, almost 30 years ago, a hospice care in, down the Thousand Oaks here. And that was, what a contrast for me, and that's really stuck with me in terms of, you know, if you're really going, a hospital is one of the, in my opinion,
yes, right,
one of the worst places you can be, and to be in surrounded by, be connected, and
right,
be with family, be with friends is so much better.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Cottage is working hard to make, for those who do die at Cottage, make it as good experience as possible, much more so than they were a few years ago. And in 6th Central now, which is the cancer area, they offer every family for somebody who dies there a body washing ritual, which is kind of like ancient things of washing bodies, like in the Islamic and Jewish tradition. But there are now other hospitals are picking up Cottage's model of how do you care for and revere a body after it's gone, after the life has passed. Because before it would just be in a, you know, I hate to say it, but in a plastic vinyl zippered thing, and it goes out with no ceremony. And so Cottage is working hard on those kinds of things to really make it much more humane and compassionate. Yes, Carol.
Well, two things. You've mentioned Father Virgil so many times. I'd like to share that I was present and holding his left hand when he died.
Uh-huh.
There were many people around.
Sure, right.
And Father Richard was by his head reading the account of Francis's death.
Really?
And it was so beautiful and so moving. And then he just slipped away peacefully. And that was really very special.
A good death.
A good death,
yes. Right.
You hadn't mentioned this, and I wonder what you think about it, of telling the person who's dying that they have permission to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very difficult, that's kind of an artsy call, you know, to know, not too soon, or not, but so in a really practical sense, anybody involved in that conversation is welcome to meet with one of our folks to talk about that. But, you know, I think it's, if it's compassion and wisdom, you know, trying to put that together. And if between the medical prognosis and sometimes maybe praying or meditating on it, feeling if it's a right time, just to say to the person, you know, love to have you here, but you have my permission to go.
I did that with my mother.
And
my only regret was that I left. She was at Mission Terrace. And she died within half an hour after I left. And I was so sad that I wasn't with her at that moment. But and another thing about her death was that Father Eddie Fronsky, whom some know, the Franciscan, had been in town before she died. And he gave her the sacrament of the dying. And a few of us were around, and she had not spoken for a couple of days before, and yet she joined in all of the prayers.
Wow.
And the rest of us were trying to remember what are these prayers. It was so touching and so beautiful.
You know, just I'll note, and some of you have been in the hospice world know this, that often families will be in vigils for a long time with a loved one, and they'll step out to take a walk, and the loved one will die. And it's an old, it's kind of just one of the lessons of the business that, it, shouldn't say business, the practice, that it could be that people don't want to die when you're in the room, and it's easier when you're gone. So we always tell people, keep a vigil if you like, but if you need to take a walk, take a walk, and it may be the time when they'll let go. It's a mystery, you don't know. But don't feel like you failed if they die when you go down the hallway. Yes, please.
You touched on so many things that I'm standing here trying to cue myself so I don't forget what I want to say.
Yeah, sure.
So many very touching things that hospice does. The six things.
Yes.
My husband, when he was dying, was in the hospital for 22 days. And those days, he spent doing those six things.
Really?
Everyone who came to visit him, he would say, oh, you're such a great woman. You did such wonderful, you know, raised a wonderful daughter. He just kept saying and thanking people and blessing them as they left. And I thought that was just so, not really out of character for him. He might say that to me about someone, but he was saying it directly to the people.
Interesting.
But if that, your card, for someone who's not ready to do that, might prompt them to do that, which would be bring up the conversation. Which the other thing, I was so thankful for hospice. They did come. He died at home with hospice there for 2 days, and then hospice was there for me. I went to the group sessions and all of that.
Oh, wonderful!
And sometimes it was just a place to be and to be with people who would understand, and it was just a wonderful experience. And that, what you just talked about leaving the room, when my father died, which was just a few weeks before my husband, there's 8 kids in the family, and he waited until the final brother came, because my mom kept telling him, oh, don't come, you were just here, and you don't need to come. Well, anyway, everyone had been there, and then I wasn't there because I went home to be with my husband, but they were all in the dining room talking and laughing and, you know, how you do, reminiscing. And my sister felt so bad because my dad died while they were all in the dining room. And I kept saying to her, no, he couldn't leave until he heard. Everybody was present, laughing and talking. And he was like, okay, everything is fine now. I can go. And that's the way I looked at it. And I think it is part of that, giving them permission to leave on their schedule.
Yeah, as you know, hearing is supposedly one of the last senses to go, so to imagine for him to hear those guys out there would be a great thing.
The question about whether to tell a person it's okay to let go reminded me of Frank Ostaseski.
Yes.
At the Mind Supermind. Thank you, Tom. At the Mind Supermind, he brought up a story, and that really stayed with me, of a young caregiver who thought it meant very really well and told this elderly lady it's okay to let go, and the lady just shot back at her. She goes, I'm the one doing the dying here, honey. And she said, don't you think robbing me of this last decision or this last shred of control is a little inappropriate? So anyway, he cautioned against that kind of, and that kind of stayed with me. So,
yes, absolutely right.
It could be tricky business.
Yes, it is a tricky business.
Yeah.
I'll say right.
Anyway.
I've got an irreverent poem we could end with, if you like. Okay, this is a poem. One of the people on our staff is Perry Longo, who's, you know. And she shared this poem with me because she thought I would like it. And so I shared it at a staff meeting. And then one of our people took it out to a group in town that meets, and it included one of people from my former congregation. And I heard back that this person could not believe that I would be sharing this poem. So I disavow. If you say that I've shared this poem, I'll disavow that. But so don't take it literally. I think this group is safe. But this is a wonderful poem by Billy Collins. It's called The Afterlife. Maybe you know it. While you are preparing for sleep, brushing your teeth, or rifling through a magazine in bed, the dead of the day are setting out on their journey. They're moving off in all imaginable directions, each according to his own private belief. And this is the secret that silent Lazarus would not reveal, that everyone is right, as it turns out. You go to the place you always thought you would go, the place you kept lit in an alcove in your head. Some are being shot into a funnel of flashing colors, into a zone of light, white as a January sun. Others are standing naked before a forbidding judge who sits with a golden ladder on one side, a coal chute on the other. Some have already joined the celestial choir and are singing as if they had been doing this forever, while the less inventive find themselves stuck in a big air-conditioned room full of food and chorus girls. Some are approaching the apartment of the female god, a woman in her 40s with short, wiry hair and glasses hanging from her neck by a string. With one eye, she regards the dead through a hole in her door. And there are those who are squeezing into the bodies of animals, eagles and leopards, and one trying on the skin of a monkey like a tight suit, ready to begin another life in a more simple key. While others float off into some benign vagueness, little units of energy heading for the ultimate elsewhere. There are even a few classicists being led to an underworld by a mythological creature with a beard and hooves. He will bring them to the mouth of the furious cave guarded over by Edith Hamilton and her three-headed dog. The rest just lie in their backs, in their coffins, wishing they could return so they could learn Italian or see the pyramids or play some golf in a light rain. They wish they could wake in the morning like you and stand at a window examining the winter trees, every branch traced with the ghostwriting of snow. So may we learn Italian and see the pyramids and play golf in the light rain. Thank you very much.